everyone. This is Paul Masetta welcoming all of you to the call tonight. Really happy that you could join me and my team here tonight. And I'm excited. It's a really beautiful night out here in New York City. And we have a lot of really cool stuff to talk about. Really, the focus of this call is going to be on first impressions. You know, they say that you never get a second chance to make a first impression, and that is absolutely true. I mean, while if you did some damage initially and you really didn't have a good first impression with somebody, you could always reverse that. You could always, you know, practice some damage control, but it takes a lot of time. There's no guarantee that it's always going to work, and to be honest with you, there's really no need for anyone to have to do that if you just get it right the first time. So I want to ask you all a question. Have you ever had an experience where you just felt that you couldn't trust the person that was right in front of you? There was just something about them that was just off. You know, it's not necessarily something that you can identify. You can't really explain it. Just something is not right. Some people call this intuition, and I don't disagree with the concept of intuition, but I prefer to really just call it the first impression, because this is really a more accurate description if we if we're going to adapt a more scientific point of view on this. You see, it's a very well-known fact that people will create long-standing beliefs about you during the first few minutes that they meet you. Now, does this mean that people are shallow? Does it mean that they don't have values? Does it mean that they're judgmental? No. Doesn't really have anything to do with any of that. It's the simple fact is that people think this way because of the survivalist mindset that has been passed down to us from our ancestors over thousands and thousands of years of evolution. And this survival mindset, which is represented by the reptilian complex, which is some people call it the reptilian brain, which is it's the oldest part of our brain. It's the part of our brain that is responsible for all the survival instincts that we have. And this part of our brain helps us decide more quickly, helps us reach decisions without wasting too much of our cognitive resources. It's a simple fact that people just do not want to have to think about every single thing that comes their way. They would rather just take these mental shortcuts. The psychological term for it is called a heuristic. And that's just what the mind would rather do. A lot of it happens unconsciously. It's not even like people are sitting around saying, hey, you know what, I really don't want to think about this. I'm going to take a shortcut. It doesn't even happen that way. It happens completely on a subconscious level. So how do people actually create their first impressions about other people? Well, forget about the verbal content of your business presentation or the topics discussed with a new acquaintance, because people really don't pay attention to those things at all when they're forming their first impressions. You see, that's a big reason why people go wrong. They pay too much attention to what they're saying verbally and not enough attention to what they're doing non-verbally. And as we all know, well, in case you don't know, non-verbal communication makes up the majority of the way that people communicate with each other. And the fact is that people are more interested in nonverbal signals or your body language when they form first impressions about you. And this is the reason why people admire and trust a lot of Hollywood celebrities and famous athletes and their endorsements, even if they really have no idea who they are in real life or what their area of expertise is or what their claim to fame is. We don't have to know those things anymore, because in our mind, these people are sending the right signals each and every time, and because of that, we trust them. Now, the same applies when we meet highly skilled communicators from different fields. It doesn't matter if the person is a computer whiz or a religious personality. It doesn't matter. If this person is a highly skilled communicator and his body language is sending the right signals every single time, chances are you're going to trust this person even before he shows you his broad knowledge, competence, expertise, experience, talent, whatever. I'm not saying that everything is tied to body language. I mean, You're going to have to show your competence and credibility at some point. But before you can get to that point, you have to show that you can be trusted. So, here's the secret behind the relationship between nonverbal and verbal communication. Both are important, and yet both need to be put side by side in such a way that you'll instantly be able to influence another person. They have to be parallel. They have to be in sync. How does this happen? Well, the answer lies in how a person aligns his body language and his verbal language. To keep it short and simple, if your nonverbal language or your body language is communicating that you're trying to hoodwink someone into buying something that's not mutually beneficial to both parties, your audience isn't going to trust what you're trying to express verbally. So if you're sending all the nonverbal signals, if all the nonverbal signals are bad, it doesn't matter what comes out of your mouth. What's going to happen is you're going to be sending mixed signals to someone, and that's where that air of distrust starts to form. That's when people start to say, there's something I don't like about this person. I can't really put my finger on it, but something isn't adding up. There cannot be a disconnect between what your body is trying to communicate and what your words are trying to convey. Because if there is, you shatter any opportunity to build rapport and trust. Now, it's very important for you to remember that people do make fast judgments based on their own memories and experiences. There are no hard and fast rules when it comes to these categories. What works for one person may not necessarily work for someone else, but there are specific traits, expressions, and gestures that are generally deemed acceptable and credible by most people. So, for example, if you see a clean-shaven man with a new crisp suit, you're not going to have any problem listening to what he has to say for the simple reason that his appearance communicates that he is credible and he can easily be trusted. Now, sometimes these images change from time to time. You know, for example, right now it's very trendy and it's kind of socially acceptable to have a little bit of facial hair, whereas years ago it really wasn't. So I just want to touch on this for a quick second because I'm the type of person that I always take my appearance very seriously and I always know the role that my appearance plays. And for years, whenever I did presentations or when I did video, I never had facial hair. And now, because it's become more socially acceptable and because there's a bigger social impact where a lot of gentlemen are having facial hair, I now we'll do a presentation from time to time where you might see a picture of me where I have some facial hair. But I was always conscious of the fact that there was a certain time where it wasn't socially acceptable. And I knew that if I did present myself in a way that's not socially acceptable, I would break trust with people. So back to my point. From the viewpoint of the majority, a person who fits the description of what is socially acceptable and credible becomes a definite yes because he's exerted extra effort to look good for his audience. When this person presents an idea or an argument, people trust him. They lower their resistance. They listen to what he has to say because on the subconscious level, he's already made the point. He's already scored the point. He's already hit the basket. He's already knocked the ball out of the park. Now, some of you might be skeptical about this theory of instant recognition and categorization. And I don't blame you because it really changes the way you view how other people perceive you on a daily basis. If you think about it, this process of quick categorization does have its benefits because people won't have to spend a lot of time or energy figuring out if a new acquaintance should be trusted or not. People might not think that it's fair, and it might not be right, but the truth be told, if people spent every moment really analyzing and trying to figure out if someone is credible or trustworthy, they would have no energy left when they really need to use their cognitive resources for everything else. I mean, we need to think about so many different things every day. Every single day we're thinking about responsibilities, what we're going to eat, what we're going to wear, what's going to happen tomorrow, what's going to happen with our families, our children, etc., etc. For us to have to think about all this other little stuff, it would literally fry our brains. So, when a person tries to communicate for the first time with his audience tries to capture his non-verbal signals. They look for gestures, facial expressions, hand gestures, appearance, and they try to tie those signals with the content of what he's saying. So early on, it's important to remember to stay completely confident in what you're saying, because if you don't, it's going to immediately resonate in your body language. Now, it might be difficult to accept that at many important junctions in our lives, we've been judged based on first impressions, but it's a reality. It's not something that we expect people to use when you're being interviewed for your dream job or when you're trying to find the love of your life, but the fact remains that people are cognitive misers, and that's not a term that I've created. That is a psychological term that you will find running rampant in any publication or book on social psychology. People are cognitive misers most of the time, and they're not going to change anytime soon. So rather than sit around and place judgment on it and form opinions on it and let it upset you, accept it for what it is and utilize it to your advantage. So to ensure that you convey the right signals to people, you have to pay attention to your body language and your appearance. So I want to talk to you about how you can take full control over your first impressions, because these first impressions can really leave a significant mark on a person's memory of you. A person's first impression can be significant, but it doesn't mean that you can't do anything to modify it at a later time. But if you think about it, like I said before, it's easier just to create a good first impression than to have to go back and modify it later. So my goal is to show you how to do this, and the strategies that I'm going to share with you are going to cover a lot of ground, because creating a good first impression involves a lot of elements. So the first thing that you always want to keep in mind, number one, is avoid competing with others. And we see this all the time in social gatherings like parties. Women particularly are sensitive to other attractive women. It has nothing to do with a person's upbringing, their values, or whether the person is cultured or not. This tendency to dislike obviously attractive people of the same sex is rooted in what I spoke about before. It's part of the survival mechanism, the instinctual thought process that resides within all of us. People tend to think of this behavior as insecurity, but it's actually competition that's to blame, not insecurity. So here's a rule of thumb when you're about to meet 1, 2, or even 10 people. You want to try to project yourself as an attractive person, but don't overdo it. And what I mean by don't overdo it is you have to know your role in that social setting. If you are the dominant person, the alpha male, the person who's in charge, then you don't have to worry about it as much. And of course, that's kind of what everyone wants to be. But there are going to be certain social situations where no matter how much you want to be the person in control, no matter how much you want to be the dominant force, the social situation that you're in is just going to say otherwise. You know, if you're in a room, if you just started a job as a mail clerk and you're in the same room as the owner or the president of the company, it's not going to do you any good to try to be the dominant force in that situation. You can covertly influence that person over time to get more opportunities from them, but to go into a social situation like that and try to be the dominant person is going to only bring you problems. So it's best if first analyze the situation, and if you are in a situation where you're either equal or, I don't want to say a lower level, because that's kind of like a bad term to use, but if you're in a social situation where you know for a fact that you are not the dominant force, then it's best if you present yourself as an equalizing force. You don't want to be a force that's so powerful that you become a threat, at least unconsciously, to other people. The key here is that you always want to be extra sensitive to nonverbal input that you get from others when you're in a situation where you're in a novel situation, like, for example, when you're meeting people for the first time. If there's ever an inexplicable resistance to your presence, that might be an indicator that you're coming on too strongly and your audience feels that you're competing with them on some level. So you have to compensate by showing them that you're not there to compete with them. You're not a threat to them. You're actually an equalizing force, and you're going to elevate their status, not lower it. Now, once that happens, you can then move into the next level of creating rapport and building from there and then forming a relationship. The next thing is be conscious of your physical shape. In the world that we live in right now, it's easy to dismiss the idea of looking good as just a media gimmick so that people will just spend tons of money on weight loss products. And part of it is, but the reality is that looking good from a scientific perspective is actually a completely positive thing, because you're exerting extra effort to rid yourself of any excess poundage that would eventually cause health problems later on. Now, you also have to take into account the fact that looking good is one of the positive traits that people tend to look for when they meet people for the first time. People have preconceived notions of what looks good and what doesn't. And whether we'd like it or not, we have to fit ourselves into this mold somehow to facilitate the process of influencing others covertly. Now, am I going to say that, you know, people that are overweight and out of shape can't influence other people? No, absolutely not. That's not what this is about. As you grow and build relationships with people, anyone can influence anyone if they have the right tools in their toolbox. But the focus of what we're talking about now is first impressions. And there's always an insatiable drive to associate ourselves with things that reflect good health. So if you keep yourself in shape, you're going to actually be investing not only in your health, but also in the public projection of yourself, which is very important when it comes to covert influence and first impressions. Okay, the third thing I want to talk about is investing in the whole package. I know that the majority of the time, people have something unique and special to offer the world, but I also know that 99.9% of the time, people can ignore this fact simply because of how a person projects himself publicly. We live in a pretty visual culture nowadays, and because of this, we have to pay close attention to the public projection of ourselves and how we look. You have to be able to differentiate between what you see in yourself and what other people see when you talk to them. These two projections are actually very different from one another. If you think you look confident and attractive when you look in the mirror, have you ever tried determining whether your current look is also considered attractive and confident by other people? If you're unsure, then the majority of the time, 9 times out of 10, you have to start reevaluating your clothing choices and even your makeup. I have a colleague in the self-improvement, personal development world, and he's very well known. I'm not going to mention his name, obviously for privacy reasons, but he's a very well known figure. He's been around for a long time. He's positively impacted the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. And in the minds of a lot of people, this guy is an icon. He has no idea how to dress. He is terrible when it comes to fashion and trends and just knowing what looks good. But he's also smart enough to know how important it is to project himself positively in the public light, that he has now hired someone, a personal assistant, who picks out his clothes for him, a woman, which is the best if you're a man. A woman is the best choice that you want to go with. And that's exactly what he's done, because he understands the importance of this. Now, I want to make myself clear. I'm not saying that you should spend an incredible amount of money to upgrade the way you look. That's far from what I'm trying to say here. What I am trying to say is that you should always look at your current style or your look and determine which elements can be improved. That's all. There's always going to be some money involved in improving the way you look, but how much money you spend is up to you. I mean, think about how much money you spend on other stuff that you can barely even remember when the month is over. I know what happens. It happens to me all the time. So it's really just a matter of taking a look at your financing, seeing where you could spend a little bit of extra money on improving your look if you need to do so. So right now, try to divert those extra funds that you have toward improving your looks. Attractiveness is not limited to people with perfect bone structure or muscular bodies. Attractiveness can be expressed in hundreds of ways, but the easiest way to do it is through your outward appearance. You can add other elements to the picture to make yourself even more attractive later, after you first taken care of the public projection. The secret to keeping yourself physically attractive is by investing in the whole package. How many years has it been since you last updated your hairstyle? If your hairstyle looked really good 10 years ago, does it still project the same confidence it did a decade ago? Look at your choice of shirts and suits. Do you look like $1 million, or do you look like a wary office worker who hasn't had the time to replace old and worn suits? Pay attention to the finer details. You know, 20 years ago, double-breasted suits in the 90s were really big. And then as we moved on to the 2000s, it was single-breasted suits for men. Now we might actually be making a turn back toward double-breasted. If we look at the fashion of people, at least in the United States nowadays, we're almost kind of back where we were in the early 80s. In the early 80s, a lot of people in America wore very tight, tapered jeans, very fitted clothes. And then as we moved into the 90s, we kind of went away from that, and most people wore, it was more trendy to wear bigger, baggier style of clothes, and now we're back to that fitted look. So a lot of these trends actually come full circle, and they totally revolve. They do a 180 degree turn, and then a 360 degree turn after that. But that's not the point. The point is to pay attention to it. The process of upgrading your looks can be painful because we're designed by nature to avoid change. But change can be a good thing. Change is always good, no matter what others might say about it, especially if the change stems from your own initiative and sound judgment. Number four, I want to talk about the intimate zone. It's going to pay for you to remember that everyone has an intimate zone that only a select group of people can safely enter without causing the other person to become concerned. You have to always remember to keep your distance, especially when you've just met someone. Now, if you can establish rapport easier, you might try to venture beyond the usual borders, but then again, why even risk it? When you're talking to another person, always maintain a good distance from the other person so that he or she will remain comfortable speaking to you. I'm not saying that other people are suddenly going to lash out at you if you speak too closely, but you may damage your first impression on that person by being an extremely close talker. A foot and a half is usually enough space to keep a conversation comfortable and engaging. Any further, and you might outwardly project that you don't feel comfortable with the other person. Any closer could be a direct intrusion on their intimate zone. This rule applies to every situation, so it doesn't matter if you're in the office, in a meeting, or in a bar. If you want to create a good first impression, keep your distance so that the other person will not have any reason to be subconsciously defensive. When someone feels secure and comfortable while you're talking, you're going to be able to convey your thoughts more easily, and your audience is going to gravitate toward your ideas. It's a win-win situation for both the influencer and the person who's being influenced. Number five, be presentable at all times. Being presentable is more than just looking good. It's actually a conscious act that shows that you respect the person that you're going to be meeting. For example, if you have an appointment with a client, you need to dress up about 10% more than you think that person would to show that you value the meeting itself. You're not going to dress up too much because this will trigger the competitive response that you don't want to trigger, but because it increases the other person's resistance to your very presence, but you do want to make sure that you're very conscious of this. And I also don't recommend dressing down because you'll also send the wrong signal, like that you don't value the other person too much, and that's why you didn't bother dressing well for the meeting. I tell this story a lot about this gentleman that I interviewed back when I was running a fitness club. And I interviewed him, and he showed up to the interview in a t-shirt and a pair of jeans. And his reasoning for that was that he felt that he was such a good salesperson, such a good influencer, and that he knew so much about the power of influence that he could ignite an ironclad rapport with just about anyone, and he would get them to look past the fact that he dressed down. And I immediately knew that he wasn't a master of influence, because if he was, he would know that environment dictates behavior. And you always need to be dressed correctly for the environment and for the social setting, because if you don't, you won't even get the opportunity to create rapport. Small touches to your wardrobe and accessories can often be the secret. If you're a man, wearing an extra nice dinner jacket or a nice watch could be significant enough. If you are a woman, wearing nice makeup and, you know, a nice bracelet or necklace could be the ticket to a better meeting or conversation. When you exert effort to be presentable, you're telling the other person that you consider it a pleasure to be with him or her, and you want them to feel good about the meeting and the interaction with you. If you don't have the time or the money to upgrade your wardrobe right now, what you can simply do now is make yourself as neat as possible. Simplicity is still the order of the day, and the simpler and neater your look, the better. By simple, I'm not saying that you should appear in a white shirt and sneakers like that gentleman that I interviewed. Stick to appropriate clothing depending on the situation, but keep your accessories minimal. Now, a lot of times when I talk about covert influence, subliminal influence, and things like this, people get these ideas in their head that I'm talking about something mystical and metaphysical. And sometimes I am. But sometimes the last thing that they expect me to talk about is being presentable in a conversation. People just say, well, there's nothing mystical, there's nothing magical, there's nothing covert, there's nothing stealth about that. But there actually is, because when you're presentable and when you become presentable during a conversation or any other social interaction, that's a very covert technique of raising the other person's status. People naturally want their social status to be elevated, because the higher a social status, the more the window of opportunity opens. You know, think about the people that you enjoy spending time with. You don't like to spend time around people that make you feel belittled or make you feel less than what you are. You like to be around people that can appreciate your humor, your wit, your experience, your talent. People that raise your social status, those are the people that you enjoy being around. Well, if you position yourself as someone who can potentially raise other people's social status, they're going to automatically consider the association with you as beneficial or advantageous and joyous in the short term and the long term. Then they'll be eager to spend time around you and learn about what you have to offer and what you bring to the table. Next, connect with your audience on different levels. Influencing other people would be effortless if you could achieve complete and unbridled harmony with your audience. In reality, this is hardly possible, because people have their own preferences and core beliefs and values, and we can only do so much to establish rapport. But nevertheless, you should always focus on eliminating potential roadblocks to the communication process. This applies most especially in situations where you have no clue about the values or even the culture of the people that you're going to be meeting. It never hurts to do some research beforehand. The goal is to mirror at least some of the common values that the other person has, so that they'll warm up to the idea of listening to you, and it'll be easier for you to ignite rapport. If you appear to be completely foreign and distant, the other person is going to have to resort to their heuristics, their mental shortcuts, to determine whether or not they should listen to you. Now, this may or may not result in an ideal situation, at least for you. Emulation is the best policy when you have to enter unfamiliar territory. You never want to show resistance to the other person's values, especially customs and cultural norms. You know, with the state of the way the internet is today, I tell this to people all the time, you know, one third of the world's population has a Facebook account. I mean, you go onto their Facebook account, if it's not private, you could see where they live, what kind of sports teams they listen to, what kind of clothing they like, what kind of hobbies they have, what kind of games they like to play, what kind of music they like to listen to, and you can learn a lot about a person. Even if you can't, even if they don't have a Facebook account, you can still try to Google them, do a little bit of research, and there are two things that you essentially want to do. You want to highlight similarities, and more importantly, you want to avoid unsimilarities. You want to avoid differences that you have with that person. As long as you're able to do those two things during your first meeting, it'll be very easy for you to ignite rapport. Next, put yourself in the other person's shoes. Now, this is an old saying, this is an old adage, but it speaks clearly a hard truth about influence, persuasion, and everything related. If you don't think like the other person, you ultimately will fail. If you want people to listen to you from the outset, you have to show them that you know exactly how you can provide the highest benefit known possible to them at the least cost, resource-wise. And it's also important that you learn what specific values matter most to them, so you can use those values as strong hooking points. So for example, if you're trying to sell an automated inventory system to a large bakery, what particular values would matter most to this type of a client? Let's say they value efficiency. How would you tie your product in with that value? In short, how does your product make life extremely easy for the client? That sort of approach to influence is going to ensure that when you go into that meeting, you'll come out victorious because you've done absolutely everything in your power to influence the other person into thinking like you do, at least when it comes to your ideas and offers. Next, I want to talk about digging deeper into the other person's values. In situations where you can freely ask questions, don't miss out on the opportunity to find out more about the other person. Probe. Keep your questions simple but meaningful, and make sure that all of the questions are relevant to the other party and to your own interests. Here's a good example. Let's say you need a big break and you want to offer a piece of software to a big company, and this deal is going to make you a lot of money. It's a high commission, and it'll enable you to potentially start your own business, and there's a lot on the line, so you really need to land this deal. Here's the problem. The other party has been in business for many years, and he can easily drop your offer for others. He has the pick of the litter when it comes to these type of offers. How do you prevent that from happening? Some people end up being intimidated by all the requirements and values of big ticket audiences. It should never be this way. Don't be intimidated by their values. Instead, use these values to your advantage. Ask questions in such a way that you gradually learn and discover what really matters the most to them. And if they say they value efficiency, ask them how they measure efficiency in their own operations. This way, you can tailor your own presentation around their own values. In the end, no one will be able to resist agreeing with you for the simple reason that if they did disagree with you, they would be disagreeing with themselves, because they would essentially be disagreeing with their own values. Number 9, uncover urgent and long-term needs. People tend to operate with an almost automatic survivalist mindset governed largely by the unconscious. I spoke about this earlier. The unconscious mind is often stronger than the conscious mind because it's also the seat of all of our emotions. And nothing could invoke such strong emotions more than needs. It doesn't matter if the need is small or big. If the need exists, the other person concerned will have strong emotions attached to the need, whether he or she admits it or not. You have to be able to differentiate between core values and present needs. your subject is going to be able to identify with you more easily if you link his own values with your presentation. But if you want him to say yes to your offer, you're also going to have to unify your arguments with his present needs. For example, a subject might value efficiency, but what he really needs right now is a tax filing system that just works. So you have to be able to evaluate what you can offer him right now, because if you discover one or more actual needs, he's going to say yes to your offer. There's no doubt about it. And last on this list tonight is mirroring. Talk about this all the time. I can't talk about it enough. Mirroring is one of the most basic ways of establishing rapport with someone. To the untrained eye, good mirroring is almost indiscernible because the gestures, expressions, and even the speech of the people conversing with one another or interacting is going to be natural. So, what is mirroring? Mirroring is simply matching the other person's speech rate, gestures, movements, expressions, etc. to improve rapport. If you haven't tried this before, it might sound a little crazy, but trust me, it's worked and it will work for you. It's easy to mirror someone during a conversation. Just be observant and learn to listen really closely to the other person. Look for changes in the way they speak or move when they try to explain something. If the speech rate drops down, do the same thing. So you'll always be walking together during the conversation. If the subject seems relaxed and happy, express the same sentiment through your facial expressions and gestures. If you find this technique difficult to implement, you can't really pull it off, just pretend that the other person in front of you is a relative or a close friend. That's all you have to do. No magic, no complicated formulas just to remember. Just that. Imagine that the other person is someone close to you. Validate that in your mind so your subconscious mind will readily accept this new information. So why am I asking you to do this? Well, the answer is very simple. We tend to behave in a certain way when we're with people we trust, that we feel close to, like friends and family. We tend to be more powerful communicators when we're with friends because the anxiety and apprehension go away when we're with familiar faces. Now, mirroring can be a little tough if you're not used to consciously controlling situations and influencing people, but it's no reason to be scared. If you feel the same way, just imagine that you have a new friend and your body language and your verbal language will adjust themselves automatically. I hope you enjoyed the information that I shared on tonight's call, and I wish you a good night, and I'll speak to you again soon.